thinkers and scholars, and of course based on some of the riwayats, sleep is kind of half of death.
The brother to death, they
brother
call
to
it,
death. Yeah,
right.
It's not a complete death. We can say that it's half of death or brother of death. That is why in our sleep, sometimes our soul departures from the body, leave our body.
Yes.
So it is possible that in that kind of cases, the soul could connect the other souls, even the souls of the deceased one. Mm-hmm. So rationally and maybe philosophically, we can say it is possible. That is why if sometimes some of the souls of the deceased ones try to contact these souls, of course, that is possible. You cannot deny and reject, particularly when sometimes based on this kind of communication, the deceased ones inform the living people from some things that is really true.
Mm-hmm.
For example, they order them to do something and they give the address, go there and do such and such a thing. That those things are there. So these kind of true dreams are reported by many people.
That's right. Yeah. And this is the main differentiation between two important schools of thought. In one of them, which is religious, they believe that dream can be an authentic channel in order to get information from the other world. In another one, they say that no, dream is something only related to the brain system. It has nothing to do with the soul. But according to what you say and according to what you Islamic believes, dream can also be related to the other world too, isn't it? For example, the soul is passing life in barzakh, and now through dreams it could be connected to the living people on the earth.
Yeah, because we have many cases, many reports of the true dreams.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why when we have such a number of true dreams, then of course we cannot deny it, because it cannot happen that if there is no departure or is no separation between the soul and body, or if there is no any connection to other souls, then how can these people get those true information?
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the criteria that we can say sometimes the true dreams, sometimes it is possible for the people to happen, yes.
That's right. In order to, let's get back to the deceased person.
Mm-hmm.
When a deceased person is dying, you know, what happened exactly to his soul? I mean, his soul is passing now life in a purgatory, as we call it in Islam, in a kind of mid-world, in a kind of barzakh. So is this soul that we are talking about now is the same soul to be resurrected, for example, or to be gotten back into the body on the day of judgment? And now it can, for example, fly here, fly there, go to the dreams or go to the mind of the people or not? It's something else.
You know, when it comes to the soul, in the Holy Quran, we see that Almighty Allah says to the Holy Prophet that whenever they ask you about soul, about ruh, قُلْ الرُّوحُ مِنْ أَمْرِ رَبِّي. Even the Holy Prophet did not explain completely that what is the nature of ruh, what is the sense of the soul and ruh. So that's why we do not know completely what ruh is exactly. But what we can say, according to the Muslim scholars and theologians particularly, so they are of the view that soul can exist after the demise of a person, and it is possible for the soul of the dead people and also the living people that sometimes they could communicate and contact each other. And about the possibility of this thing, we cannot reject and deny it completely. But of course, because sometimes there are some people who might wrongly or mistakenly, or let's say they want to misguide and deceive some people, they go to the living people saying that, yeah, your deceased father or mother said such and such, you know, because this door should not be opened for the people.
Yes.
That's
they kind of guess to superstitions
for example, null
and void, for example.
Yeah, there are many people who misuse this kind of things.
Yeah, misuse and abuse this concept. Yeah. That's right.
Okay. That is why it depends that what kind of people see in the dreams, what kind of people they are. Okay, can we trust them or not, you know?
And the mu'abbirin also interpreters of the dreams, they must be authentic. It has its own, we can say, etiquette. It has its own styles. That's all right. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a break. After break, we'll get to the second question for today's discussion.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Okay, welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. You're listening to Question and Answer on Islamic Belief. Sheikh Rouhani is over here to answer today's question. Sheikh Rouhani, we know that Imam Ali alayhi salam was the ruler of the Islamic lands for about 5 years. But there are so many stories of his close relatives, like Aqil, his brother, referring to him to get help because they were living in a destitute life, a poor life, and Imam Ali alayhi salam did not do so. What was the main reason from the side of Imam Ali alayhi salam? Because he helped all the fuqara, and why not helping the brother Aqil? Is this true or not?
First of all, we should know that Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu was salam, he was always helping and supporting and donating for the poor people. It is for sure, and there is no doubt about
even
it.
Even when he was not the king or
the course.
Ruler.
Yeah, of course.
Yes.
But as it is mentioned in the Holy Quran, وَيَتْعِمُونَ الطَّعَامَ عَلَى حُبِّهِ مِسْكِينًا وَيَتِيمًا وَأَسِيرًا.
Yes,
this ayah is related to Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi salatu wa salam.
Hazrat Fatimah al-Zahra.
And Lady Zahra, yes, and the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wa salam. So, of course, there is no doubt about that. But when it comes to this specific case about Aqil, yeah, your question is about
Yes, about the brother.
First of all, we should know that what Aqil asked from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, that was a huge amount of dirham or money. The amount of money or dirham that Aqil asked from his brother Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam was about 100,000 dirham.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a huge amount of money.
Yes.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam at that time didn't have that much money.
He was the caliph on that time when Aqil asked this question?
And then you see that Amir al-Mu'minin said that, okay, you know that I do not have such amount of money from my own self.
Uh-huh.
And of course, I'm not allowed and I'm not allowed to give you such amount of money from the Baytul Mal, yeah?
Mm-hmm, the public funds.
The public funds,
which was in the hand of the caliph
of course.
The time. That's right.
So that is why, first of all, what Aqil expected from Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, was not possible for Amir al-Mu'mineen to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, said that, please wait.
Mm-hmm.
When my share from Baytul Mal was given to me, I will inshallah give it to you.
Uh-huh.
But then Aqil said, okay, your share on Baytul Mal is not that much.
Mm-hmm.
It's very few and I need more money. So then Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu wasalam says, so what can I do? If I cannot give you from the Baytul Mal such amount of money, and also I cannot give you from my own share on the Baytul Mal to you, so then there is no any solution.
Mm-hmm.
That is why Imam Ali alayhi salam in that specific case could not give that amount of money to his brother Aqil.
Mm-hmm.
So it shows the justice of Amir al-Mu'mineen, that how Amir al-Mu'mineen was just and fair enough, particularly in regards with the Baytul Mal, public funds. Yeah.
Okay. And is it true that Imam Ali alayhi salam put a kind of hot iron or a stone in the hand of Aqil?
Yeah, it is. It is also narrated that Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam wanted to test his brother.
Okay.
That, okay, oh brother, if you cannot tolerate this small piece of hot iron in your hand, then how can you let
How do you expect me, for example, tolerate
to be burned
the hellfire?
And see how much
the strategy of Ali ibn Abi Talib in leading the community is different from the previous caliphs, especially from the Umayyad ones, the Muawiyah, for example, you know, with lots of money and establishing lots of palaces here and there. It's really, we can't say it's a different, but it's not the way that he's portrayed, that, for example, Imam Ali alayhi salam didn't want to help Aqil.
Of course, he did want, but, you know, the amount of money, which was 100,000 dirham, it is narrated by Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salatu wasalam. It's well known that after the demise and the shahada of Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, when they counted all the heritage and inheritance of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salatu wasalam, they only found 700 dirham, which was extra kind of things from the properties and wealth of Amir al-Mu'mineen. So it was also given to some of the servants of Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, and he didn't have any more kind extra kind of property or wealth in his inheritance.
Our dear listeners can refer to Sharh Nahj al-Balagha by Ibn Abi al-Hadid, volume 11, page 245, or we can say Al-Irshad al-Ghulub by Daylami, volume 2, page 216, in order to know more about the story of Aqil and Amir al-Mu'mineen, of establishing of the justice and the public fund. Really, really a good lesson for today's people and today's politician who have access to the public fund and treasury of their countries, that how Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam was careful about this important point, especially when it was the rights of the yatim, orphans, the right of the destitute, faqir, the rights of the oppressed, mazlumin and mustazafin, even captives, you know, even captives, those people who we can say who were lost on the way, and all these people have been helped by Imam Ali alayhi salam. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding these two important topics for today's discussion, the authenticity of our dreams and also the help of Amir al-Mu'mineen to Aqil ibn Abi Talib. It was very kind of you.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن
A letter to the children of Gaza. I returned a few days ago from Egypt. On the flight, I wrote a letter to the children of Gaza, and I would like to close my talk with this letter. Dear child, it is past midnight. I am flying at hundreds of miles an hour in the darkness, thousands of feet over the Atlantic Ocean. I'm traveling to Egypt. I will go to the border of Gaza at Rafah. I go because of you. You have never been in a plane. You have never left Gaza. You know only the densely packed streets and alleys, the concrete hovels. You know only the security barriers and fences patrolled by soldiers that surround Gaza. Planes for you are terrifying. Fighter jets, attack helicopters, drones. They circle above you. They drop missiles and bombs, deafening explosions. The ground shakes. Buildings fall. The dead, the screams, the muffled calls for help from beneath the rubble. It does not stop, night and day. Trapped under the piles of smashed concrete, your playmates, your schoolmates, your neighbors, gone in seconds. You see the chalky faces and limp bodies when they are dug out. I am a reporter. It is my job to see this. You are a child. You should never see this. The stench of death, rotting corpses under the broken concrete. You hold your breath. You cover your mouth with a cloth. You walk faster. Your neighborhood has become a graveyard. All that was familiar is gone. You stare in amazement. You wonder where you are. You are afraid. Explosion after explosion. You cry. You cling to your mother or father. You cover your ears. You see the white light of the missile and wait for the blast. Why do they kill children? What did you do? Why can't anyone protect you? Will you be wounded? Will you lose a leg or an arm? Will you go blind or be in a wheelchair? Why were you born? Was it for something good? Or was it for this? Will you grow up? Will you be happy? What will it be like without your friends? Who will die next? Your mother? Your father? Your brothers and sisters? Someone you know will be injured soon. Someone you know will die soon. At night you lie in the dark on the cold cement floor. The phones are cut. The internet is off. You do not know what is happening. There are flashes of light. There are waves of blast concussions. There are screams. It does not stop. When your father or mother hunts for food or water, you wait. That terrible feeling in your stomach. Will they come back? Will you see them again? Will your tiny home be next? Will the bombs find you? Are these your last moments on Earth? You drink salty, dirty water. It makes you very sick. Your stomach hurts. You are hungry. The bakeries are destroyed. There is no bread. You eat one meal a day, pasta, a cucumber. Soon, this will seem like a feast. You do not play with your soccer ball made of rags. You do not fly your kite made from old newspapers. You have seen foreign reporters. We wear flak jackets with the word press written on them. We have helmets. We have cameras. We drive jeeps. We appear after a bombing or a shooting. We sit over a coffee for a long time and talk to the adults. Then we disappear. We do not usually interview children. But I have done interviews when groups of you crowded around us, laughing, pointing, asking us to take your picture. I have been bombed by jets in Gaza. I have been bombed in other wars, wars that happened before you were born. I, too, was very, very scared. I still have dreams about it. When I see the pictures of Gaza, these wars return to me with a force of thunder and lightning. I think of you. All of us who've been to war hate war most of all because of what it does to children. I tried to tell your story. I tried to tell the world that when you are cruel to people, week after week, month after month, year after year, decade after decade. When you deny people freedom and dignity, when you humiliate and trap them in an open-air prison, when you kill them as if they were beasts, they become very angry. They do to others what was done to them. I told it over and over. I told it for 7 years. Few listened. And now this. There are very brave Palestinian journalists. 50 of them have been killed since this bombing began. They are heroes. So are the doctors and nurses in your hospitals. So are the UN workers, almost 100 of whom have been killed. So are the ambulance drivers and medics. So are the rescue parties that lift up the slabs of concrete with their hands. So are the mothers and fathers who shield you from the bombs. But we are not there. Not this time. We cannot get in. We are locked out. Reporters from all over the world are going to the border crossing at Rafah. We are going because we cannot watch this slaughter and do nothing. We are going because hundreds of people are dying a day, including over 100 children. We are going because this genocide must stop. We are going because we have children, like you, precious, innocent, loved. We are going because we want you to live. I hope one day we will meet. You will be an adult. I will be an old man, although to you I am already very old. In my dream for you, I will find you free and safe and happy. No one will be trying to kill you. You will fly in airplanes filled with people, not bombs. You will not be trapped in a concentration camp. You will see the world. You will grow up and have children. You will become old. You will remember this suffering, but you will know it means you must help others who suffer. This is my hope, my prayer. We have failed you. This is the awful guilt we carry. We tried, but we did not try hard enough. We will go to Rafah, many of us, reporters. We will stand outside the border with Gaza and protest. We will write and film. This is what we do. It is not much, but it is something. You will tell your story again. Maybe it will be enough to earn the right to ask for your forgiveness. Thank you.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a very interesting question, which is a question related to these days that we are currently in. As you know, we are in the days of the Ayyam Fatimiyya. These are the days in which we mourn the demise of the lady Fatimah al-Zahra, salamullah alayha, as well as her attainment of martyrdom. And therefore, we would like to offer our condolences to our esteemed listeners on this very grave day. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a historical event and answering a question related to it. And that question is this: what is the Mubahila and The offshoot of this question, or the subcategory of this issue, is what is its relation to the Lady Fatima, and how is it a virtue for her? The event of Mubayla is an event that occurred in the life of the Holy Prophet, in which the Christians of Najran, they were coming and arguing with the Holy Prophet concerning matters of faith in general, and specifically about the Prophet Isa, salamullah alayhi. And after a lot of argumentation and a lot of dialogue and conversation occurred from both sides, and the Christians of Najran were not satisfied with the answers of the Prophet, or they didn't want to submit and admit to the fact that they had been defeated in this debate, a verse of the Holy Quran was revealed in Surah Ali Imran, verse 61. This verse goes as follows: should anyone argue with you, meaning the Prophet, concerning him, meaning the Prophet Jesus, after the knowledge that has come to you, say, come, let us call our sons and your sons, our women and your women, our souls and your souls, then let us pray earnestly and call Allah's curse upon the liars. Now, this, the question, so what happened is that Allah asked the Prophet to tell them to bring the most dearest and the most loved people that they had and come together at a certain place and to mutually invoke curses upon one another. And the person upon whom God's wrath would descend would be known as the people who were following the false creed, and the people who were saved would be known as the people following the true creed. This was a way that they would discern who was on the right path. And it's been narrated that as a representative of the women of Islam, the Prophet brought his daughter, the Lady Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha. And this shows us that, you know, this is one of her virtues, because it shows us that she was the dearest of women in his eyes and the most respectful and the most noblest of them in his eyes. And as a follow-up, we can say that when the Christians of Najran, then they came to the place where they were to mutually invoke the curse upon, you know, upon one another, and they, from a distance, they saw the household of the Prophet, and they were utterly in awe of them, and, you know, they became very fearful of it. They became certain that take this act of mubahila to its end, they would definitely be the object of God's wrath. So they decided to terminate, the mubahila, and they came to the Prophet and they said, they asked him to give them respite, and they decided to pay what is called in Islamic jurisprudence a jizya, a tax that non-Muslims who live in Muslim government, under the auspices of Muslim government, pay in order for protection and security. This is what occurred. This is also another testament to the virtue of that noble household in general, as well as the noble lady Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the event of Mubahila as a testament to the virtue and the nobility of the lady Fatima al-Zahra. Salamullah alayha. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we answer the queries, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. Well, today in our studio, we have with us very talented expert. She is Sister Salma Khalafan, and the more I talk about her, it is less indeed. Well, she's an expert in Islamic upbringing, and today we have had this pleasure to invite her. And we're going to discuss some of the very important issues, especially regarding the teenagers, with her today. Assalamu alaikum, ma'am.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, sister, how can one go about training a teenage to be a good Muslim?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. That's, I think, the dream of all parents, Muslim parents. They want their teenage child to be even a very good Muslim. Because when you start training a teenage to become a good Muslim, from that ripe age, it reaps a great deal of results when he grows up and he starts understanding more, and he becomes more practicing a Muslim.
Right.
Every dream of a Muslim family is to train the children, especially the teenage, in the right way to become a very good Muslim. So Muslim is, first of all, what who does the sleep, submitting to the will of Allah.
All right.
So it's not something that, we feel Muslim is like any sect of the one who believes
so
in God.
So you're trying to say the word Muslim or the word Islam, they have somewhere the derivation from this word of taslim, which means submitting.
Submitting to the will of Allah.
Yeah.
Whatever Allah says, is that you've accepted it.
Right.
That's what a true Muslim is. So that's what we want for a child.
Yeah.
So the first thing is that because we know that now he shaped his personality, the teenage child.
Yeah.
So he would like being compared. So never compare that child to another child.
That's the biggest problem with the parents.
Yeah. They can't refrain it because they want so much goodness for the child. They would tell the child that, look, this child, they do it sometimes very innocently.
Yeah.
Look at this child. They feel that the child will be encouraged, that now they want to compete with the other child.
They never know how much
they're
spoiling.
But it doesn't happen. It happens like it shows like with a kind of reversion.
Yeah.
That, oh, now that you're saying this, I'll do the opposite. So never compare, because he has made his personality, his shakhsiyah, in such a way that he likes himself. Everybody loves themselves. So you can't say that, look at this person. So-and-so behaves in such a nice way. So-and-so prays on time. So-and-so goes to the mosque every day. So-and-so is half is a Quran.
Yeah.
First of all, the things that are beyond the wajibats, never mention them. First of all, what is incumbent? Even that should not be mentioned. But never mention that those things that are, supererogatory. Like the mustahabats, for example, hifz al-Quran, going to the mosque. Main thing is that even we should not compare them with other, in another way. Let alone these things that are extra to be done. It'll put them off all the more. So youth never likes being compared to.
Because in that age, self-love is one of the greatest loves that they find in the entire world, and they feel so bad while getting compared with the other children.
And they also find motivation in their self-love. Because when you feel that you're satisfied with yourself, then you want to do some other things. You want to go forward. And that's very healthy. It's yeah. okay. So at this age, because they've found themselves finally, you know, that they start to be motivated in doing things for themselves also. Right. So when you compare them, they'll get a complex in them.
Right.
And I'm not as good after all.
Okay.
So it'll stop them. And that's not very healthy
at
all.
So they have a particular kind of attitude when they are in that age. And how to be dealing with that sensitive phase of life with the children? I'll be asking you that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. Today we have Sister Salma Khalfan with us, helping us on some very important Islamic upbringing topics, especially with the teenagers. Yes, Sister, you were talking something very, very important.
Yes, I was talking about not comparing the teenagers with other people.
Yeah.
So you see, this comparison, when it's not in any matter, what happens is that they hate to listen to your words. They'll feel that, you know, my parent is always trying to advise me when it's not needed or compare me. You know, it spoils the picture
right.
altogether.
So what we are actually discussing here for the audiences who are just joining us, we are discussing how do you train your teenager to be a good Muslim. But Sister Salma Khalfan has put here a very important thing that parents usually do, maybe sometimes because of their innocence, that's the comparisons. They sometimes compare the practical good Muslim with their child, see how that child offers prayers, see how that child goes to the mosque, see how that child has memorized the Quran, see how that child has done this and that. And this, you're saying, that may give the reverse action because they are in the self-love world. Rather than encouraging your own child, you are actually comparing them with others. So isn't it like this way, they will not only feel bad about the one who they are being compared with, but also about being a Muslim?
And themselves. It would motivate them to do. They'll get a complex that I'm not good enough because he was compared or she was compared to. See? So they'll stop and become stagnant. And, you know, you're doing more good than, more harm than good. In the process, feeling initially that probably you're doing something, you know, very sweet to them by reminding them.
Yeah.
But it's okay to compare them when they were before themselves. For example, if a child at the age of 12 was praying or fasting, and when he reaches 14, he doesn't pray on time, you can tell them nicely, remember when you were 12, you were praying on time and you were going to the mosque. Those times were so beautiful for you, right? Allah was probably so pleased with you. Why don't you start that again? Comparing themselves with themselves is okay.
Okay.
But not with people.
Right.
Because they'll get a complex and they will not be motivated and they will give a wrong action, you know, in reverse. Like they will tend to disobey you.
So even if you want to convey something through compare them with themselves,
yes.
not others. Because you are saying that comparing with the others will give a kind of reverse results, and we really don't want that. We want our children to be obedient to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and to make them so, we got to be comparing them with, if we want to compare, just compare them with themselves, not others. Sister will be discussing more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, one of the things that I will never leave doing until I die is greeting children so that it becomes a tradition after me.
Welcome Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have Sister Salma Khalfan today with us in the studio, who is helping us with some very important facts about the teenage upbringing. And Sister has told us to make your teenager a good Muslim. Stop comparing him with other Muslim children who may be good at practicing Islam, practicing religion, even if they are good enough, but you should never compare your child with the others. Rather, if you want a comparison, you can only compare your child with himself. Yes, sister.
Yes, at last but not least, if you were to put it a good word, then you can always encourage them of the things that they are doing, you know, whatever they're already practicing. That's a good way to, you know, make them a good Muslim.
Okay.
Instead of comparing, like, encourage them, whatever they're doing.
Encourage
already,
them.
Yeah.
So encourage them for the good things.
Yeah, for whatever they're doing already.
All right.
For example, if they are praying, even at the last hour, you can tell them, at least you're praying.
Yeah.
You know, this is something so good. There are people out there who are not praying. And if imagine you would pray on time, how it would be.
Yeah.
You're so young. It would be such a great effect for you.
What if sometimes the parents use, or what if sometimes parents use quotes like, you know, like we have in Persian, we say, "Be namaz nagu kar daram, be kar begu namaz daram."
Yes.
Don't say to your prayers that I have some work right now. Say to your work, I have prayers right now.
Yes.
So it can be, I think, using
motivational
quotes.
One of the martyrs said that, you know, that don't tell the buzz that I have work.
Yeah.
The work that I have the buzz.
Exactly.
So, like, you know, these kind of
motivation
should be kept at home.
Yeah.
As in, like, a hadith form.
To make them, you know, praying in the first time.
Yes. To make them pray on time, of course.
Yeah.
But you start off like this. See?
Yeah.
Not discouraging them. Encourage them so that they
through
can.
Different ways.
They don't want to not hear your words. Otherwise, they feel altogether just don't want to hear your words.
Yeah.
If you start comparing them.
Right.
So that's for one, how to make them good Muslims. Another one is stimulating their emotions.
Okay.
How do you stimulate their emotions? Through the language of love.
Okay.
How is that done? It's shown with respect at that age. When you're a teenager, more than the love that you usually give a child, like as in hugging, kissing and things like that, you show it through respect.
Okay.
You know? Like when they come in, you have to like acknowledge that they've come.
All right.
Don't just think that, oh, somebody who's every day living in this under
like
this
Prophet,
roof.
Like Prophet, peace be upon him, would stand up and he would
yes.
see Lady
like
Fatima.
Like doing salam to the children.
Yeah.
And asking them how their day was.
Yeah.
So and realizing their moods, like telling them, you know, what's the matter? If they're a bit sad or you know, angry or
upset with something.
Yeah, you can talk about it to me.
Yeah.
Giving them that kind of concern
support.
Would make them feel that my parents care about me.
Yeah.
So they want the best for me. So if they tell me to do these things, they are for my best. So, of course,
show your care.
He will get that, yeah, food for thought. The love and the respect is very important to show when they're teenagers, so that they can be good Muslims.
Yeah.
They will also learn how to love. A person who has grown up in a family who has seen love from their like parents will know how to love. Otherwise, they wouldn't know how to love. You know, there are people who we have examples of.
So what you're trying to tell here is that if you start showing care and concern to your child, tomorrow your child will be showing this care and concern when he has his own family.
Yes.
So you expressing your care and concern are not only making up the life of a child, but also making up his future life.
That's right. Absolutely. So that's why it's so important to give him. And that's the satisfaction of the soul.
Right.
Indeed. You see, the body satisfaction is very short-lived, limited.
Yeah.
That you get through food and, you know, through other things, amenities that you need. But that kind of it's like a painkiller in a way. You need that to grow to become better, like to go forward.
Exactly.
But love is something that is a need of your soul.
Need of soul.
And that is more
love, care,
it is
concern.
More important for yeah. every child.
Right. Thank you so much, sister, for being with us and sharing such beautiful information with us and helping parents, children all together. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
This is Gaza Under Attack, coming to you from the British capital, London. I'm Saeed Pourreza, with you for some of the biggest talking points coming out of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza and its intensifying raids in the West Bank. First off, a quick roundup. Apartheid Israel continues its genocidal campaign against the 2.3 million Palestinians living in the world's largest open-air prison, also known as the Gaza Strip. Even as the United Nations General Assembly overwhelmingly passes a resolution demanding a humanitarian ceasefire. The humanitarian crisis in the coastal enclave is deepening, with the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees saying Gaza has become one of the most dangerous places in the world. Meanwhile, more than 2 months into the war on Gaza, the resistance fighters are still standing. The Israeli army says 10 of its occupation soldiers, including a commander, were killed in the Strip on December 12 alone. Also, an admission by the U.S. and the EU of the Israeli military's indiscriminate bombing of Gaza and how that is costing the regime in Tel Aviv in public opinion terms. At least 18,612 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli attacks since October 7th. In the same period, at least 281 Palestinians, including 64 minors, have been killed in Israeli attacks in the occupied West Bank. So what now? What is the significance of that UN General Assembly resolution? Has the US-led Western world seen enough Palestinians killed and maimed to try and stop the bloodshed? What happens if and when the shelling stops and the fog of war clears? And what can the pro-Palestine masses around the world do to keep the pressure on and to put an end to the siege of Gaza and to apartheid? Let's tackle those questions and more with academic consultant UK and South Asia, Dr. Syeda Annie Waqar. Dr. Waqar joined UNICEF as a goodwill ambassador to Commonwealth countries in 2002. She has also extensively researched the various issues relating to nuclear security in South Asia and the Middle East, defense, arms control, and international relations. And via Skype from Leicester, optician and founder of Friends of Al-Aqsa, an NGO based in the same city, Ismail Patel. Mr. Patel is also an advisory board member of the Conflicts Forum, director of Islam Expo, and a member of the special advisory board of Clear Conscience. Thanks for joining us, to both of you. Starting with you, Dr. Waqar, I usually try to start the show by asking our guests for their thoughts on what we have been seeing happening, unfolding in the Gaza Strip, in the West Bank. As early as today, exclusive video was aired on the Qatari news channel of bodies piled up inside a school in Al-Fallujah area, west of Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza, with people shot in the back of the head at point blank. Your thoughts, really, on that?
I mean, first of all, it's one of the most horrendous, you know, unfolding of events that is happening in front of us. And with whatever has been happening with the Palestinians, especially, it's just an eye-opener for the international community as well, because this just did not start on October 7th. This has been going on for many, many years. And with what we have at the minute, an apartheid state, which is actually making sure in every way that they have nobody left, especially when it comes to the younger generation. Obviously, I mean, as an academic, reading up the history of the whole of this conflict, you can clearly see how the Zionist agenda within the Israel administration has been put forward in such a way and how it's been indoctrinated into the society, or the Israeli society, that it makes it quite evident that they want to actually take over even those occupied Palestinian territories. So it's very clear from history to now. And I think what it has actually made, actually mostly the international community, most of the Western academics that I'd been actually working with, who had no actually idea of the history, or much of the history of Israel and Palestine, it's an eye-opener for them, because now they're actually looking back, not on the basis of, you know, whatever has been happening in terms of the religious aspect of it, but as a humanitarian, you know. If you have even an ounce of humanity in you, you would actually go back and look at these history books and see where, how this conflict started and what exactly is happening now. So I think it's quite welcoming to see that in the UN General Assembly, the 153 states actually went on to go ahead with the ceasefire. But the problem is not that. The problem is that one of the biggest country, which is apparently the powerful country in the world, has not actually been able to
support it.
So that's quite appalling to see.
And speaking of this being an eye-opener, people not knowing about the history before that, it's also an eye-opener that there's such a lack of information out there. And I think the recent events have helped that change. Let's bring in Dr. Patel. Dr. Patel, on that UN General Assembly resolution, okay, the U.S. expectedly voted against it, just like it did in the UN Security Council just last week. But what I would like to ask you is, what do you think is the significance of it, despite knowing that it's a non-binding resolution?
Well, I think what has happened is the United States of America, and particularly by repeatedly supporting Israel and vetoing the resolutions of the Security Council, has made the UN unfit for purpose. And this undermining of the United Nations really is very, very dangerous, because now we have one body that tries and bring about a united move for the global society, the global nations, to work towards resolving an issue. By America continually vetoing resolutions against Israel, or for what to bring Israel into account, means that it's undermining the whole structure, not of the United Nations and of how the world governing bodies can operate. And I think that is very dangerous situation that we're in. And I think the United Nations itself is in jeopardy as an organization and as a body to
we'll
move forward.
We'll talk about the UN and its role, its legitimacy as a body. But do you think the fact that so many countries voted for that resolution at the UN General Assembly ended up isolating the United States and Israel and a number of other countries who should be named and shamed, of course, for not having done so?
Absolutely. I mean, it exposes the globe in a way that, unlike any other time, the fact that almost 90% of the world wants a ceasefire, two nations in particularly, United States supporting Israel and United Kingdom abstaining, shows that they are isolated in the world. It also shows the hypocrisy of these two countries, and particularly Britain and USA, that they cannot go around the world and talk about democracy, the principles of humanitarian law, and the right of self-determination, when they themselves are undermining that for the Palestinian people. So not only does it expose them in support of Israel, but it also exposes them of their hypocrisy and their duplicity.
Correct. Dr. Waghar, based on your work on nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament in the Middle East, why do you think Israel has so for many years been exempt from nuclear disarmament talks or even inspections? We know Israel does not acknowledge that it has nuclear weapons, nor does it deny it. You know, there's always a state of ambiguity about its nuclear program or capability. Why do you think that is? Despite the fact that we know they're so irresponsible, there's no restraint in the terms of the military action they take, as we are seeing it happen in the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, this is a very interesting question, and I'm glad that you've actually asked it, because, well, I have extensively researched on nuclear proliferation, especially in the region. Looking at the history of Israel, you'll see that they have always had this nuclear ambiguity, and this is one of their very important stance when it comes to...
Their modus operandi.
Yes, modus operandi. But historically, if we look back, during the 1960s, there was a memorandum that was sent by Henry Kissinger to President Nixon. And in that memorandum, basically, it was stated that although it's quite dangerous that Israel already has the nuclear capability, mm-hmm. and they are actually working towards it, so it would be wise to actually have some sort of a leverage with them, or have a sort of a deal with them, mm-hmm. so that it's eventually it will not actually be a hindrance or be actually dangerous within the Middle East. Also, during that time, as you know, the tension between the Soviets and the US and obviously the Middle East. So they wanted to have a bit of a leverage. So it's obviously that memorandum is actually quite a secret classified document, but, you know, some parts of it had been released and, you know, most of the people can actually view it online.
You saw the revelations by Mordecai Vanunu, that nuclear whistleblower.
Yes. So so it's quite interesting to see how they were actually provided with phantom fighters to leverage for this nuclear ambiguity, because they did not want this to come out. And if it did, obviously that would have implications for the rest of the Middle East, also for U.S. own interest. Mm-hmm. So I think if you look back at the history, you'll see that this is how it started. But most of the times with all these international treaties and international organization, the countries usually actually do cheat on them. Mm-hmm. And mostly the superpowers, who are the ones who are the harbinger for creating these international treaties and laws, are the ones who actually have loopholes or have created loopholes where they can actually leverage on those bases. And this is exactly what the United States did with Israel. They said, you sign the treaty, NPT, and we will and keep it as ambiguous, and we'll let you have these concessions. All which, right. Unfortunately, they did not sign.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thanks for that history there. Yeah. We spoke at the United Nations. Let's talk about that a little more. The UN General Assembly voted overwhelmingly on December 12th to demand a humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza, as we've been saying, in a strong demonstration of global support for ending the genocide in Gaza. The vote also shows the growing isolation of the U.S. and Israel. The leaders of the Arab group, led by Palestine's UN Ambassador Riyad Mansour, said, quote, this draft resolution demands an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. The Arab group has vowed to keep up the pressure to secure a cessation of violence.
We will not rest until we see compliance of Israel with this demand from the General Assembly, so that we can see a ceasefire in place, so that we can move into the massive amount of truckloads of assistance, humanitarian assistance, of food, medicine, water, and fuel, in order to run the hospitals, to run the plants for desalination, and all needs of the things that we need, our people to need for survival. Today was a historic day in terms of the powerful message that was sent from the General Assembly, and it is our collective duty to continue in this path until we see an end to this aggression against our people, to see this war stopping against our people. It is our duty to save lives. Saving lives is much nicer and better than taking it away. Death is bad. Life is wonderful. We thought that having pauses for a few days without fighting, then to be renewed, would create an atmosphere and dynamic of a permanent ceasefire. It did not work, which means that the main force, which is the United States of America, was still intact, siding with Israel completely and not being cracked. Now, and even last Friday and today, it was obvious that this powerful force is beginning to crack.